Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, fj@offbeatoregon.com, your host for today's Offbeat Oregon History Podcast episode. Thanks for downloading, and I sure hope you enjoy it. This story is part one of a two-part presentation going into the operations of William Dunbar's role in the Lotan Blum Dunbar Gang. A seemingly tiny piece of audacious lawbreaking, among the eventual ramifications of which would be the fall of Nazi Germany and the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's part of a total run of six podcast episodes drawing from three different Offbeat Oregon columns. In the last episode, we finished the story of Jim Lotan, the minor political hack whose good fortune in being made responsible for preventing smuggling in Portland Harbor led to him reaching out to some friends to get an industrial-grade smuggling operation underway out of Portland Harbor. In today's and tomorrow's episodes, we'll take a deep dive into that smuggling operation and its deep-pocketed main operator, William Dunbar. Now, since these articles were originally published at different times and out of sequence with one another, some story elements will end up getting repeated from one to the next. This one was published on December 1st of 2022 under the headline, Blum and Dunbar Smuggled Opium by the Shipload. Here we go. About 50 years ago, the Good Friday earthquake changed Alaska forever. It killed 9 people and slammed the West Coast with tsunamis that killed 122 more, including 4 in Oregon. It did something else too, though. It heaved up the seafloor of the inside passage near the ghost town of Catalia by a good 12 feet. And in the process, it brought something up to the surface that was a very important piece of the history of Alaska, and earlier, of Oregon. It was a small wooden-hulled steamship with a screw propeller. Most of the wood had been eaten away by time and wildlife, but the steam engine and other hard parts inside were still there and visible. This wrecked ship turned out to be the remains of the SS Portland, the most famous steamer in Alaska's history, the one that kicked off the Klondike Gold Rush when it arrived in Seattle in 1897 with the famous ton of gold on board. The Portland was almost like the mascot of the Klondike Gold Rush, so Alaskan history buffs were very excited about the find. But Alaska wasn't the only state with cause for celebration. The Portland had a prominent role in Oregon's history, too. It had been as notorious in early 1890s Portland as it became famous in late 1890s Alaska. Before the ship was bought by a Seattle shipping company and renamed the SS Portland, its name was the SS Haitian Republic. It was based out of Portland, and it was probably the most notorious smuggling ship on the West Coast. It was operated by a group of smugglers whose clumsiness and ineptitude was like something out of a Keystone Cops comedy, so its name was in the Portland newspapers a lot. Every reader in Portland knew that ship and knew the names of its owners, Nat Blum and William Dunbar of the Merchant Steamship Company. William Dunbar was the senior partner in the operation. Dunbar, a native of Scotland, had come to Oregon in the 1870s and by the late 1880s was the owner of Turner Flouring Mills. Looking for a market for his flour and the wheat that he had contracts for, Dunbar discovered that buyers in China really liked the quality of his Oregon-grown wheat and flour, with which they'd make cakes and noodles of various types. So he started shipping his products to China. China today is a major buyer of Oregon's soft white winter wheat, and Dunbar was the merchant who first opened that door which led directly to that packet of ramen that got you through college. The trade made him very wealthy. Dunbar was soon making enough money to purchase his own steamship, and then another. He used the two steamers, the Haitian Republic and also one called the Wilmington, which had, by the way, an iron hull, a fact that would become important later, to expand beyond the grain freight business and into the wholesale grocery business. The steamships ran out of the Dunbar Produce and Grocery Wharf near the site of the Burnside Bridge on the west side of the river. By the end of the 1880s, Dunbar was one of the most respected and influential members of Portland's business community and a member of the Arlington Club. But all apparently was not well with him. It's not clear what happened to push Dunbar over the edge into industrial-scale criminal enterprise. It may have been the death of his wife, although that happened a long time before this. It may have been the influence of Nat Blum, a flamboyant cigar store owner who was a junior partner in Merchant Steamship Company. Or maybe he was criminally inclined all along, believing on a philosophical level that the U.S. government had no right to tell him what he could and could not do with his steamships. Or maybe he just hated waste. After all, nobody in Portland was buying shiploads of Chinese goods, so every time one of his steamships left Portland loaded with grain and bound for buyers in China, it had to sail back home in ballast. Not only was the return trip wasted, but Dunbar had to pay draymen to load and unload the ballast rocks that would keep the ship stable and safe. We can imagine him thinking about this. What cargo can I bring back from China to Portland on the return voyages after bringing wheat from Portland to China? We know he tried oranges. They didn't seem to have worked out, probably because California was growing so many oranges that could be had for cheaper. Eventually, he settled on a couple of cargoes that would be extremely lucrative for him and which could not be sourced from California: people and opium. Although both were equally illegal, people would be the safer of the two cargoes. The Chinese Exclusion Act had been passed in 1882, slamming the door on Chinese laborers who wanted to come to America to work. But plenty of Chinese people still wanted to come to America, and in those pre-driver's license years, once they arrived, no one would be able to tell they were in the country illegally. All they needed was a well-connected, sympathetic smuggler to bring them across the sea and provide either forged entry papers or, you know, sneak them ashore in the middle of the night. Someone like William Dunbar. As for the opium, in the 1890s, opium was still perfectly legal. But it was subject to a very heavy tax of $12 per pound. That's about $375 in modern money. And that, on a product that today sells in the international market for less than $50 a pound, there is a reason for that high tax, though. The vast majority of Americans viewed smoking opium as the ne plus ultra of debauchery and dissipation. Much of the population didn't care about smuggling Chinese workers into the country, but most Americans would if they learned you were smuggling in opium, rat you out to the police in a heartbeat. There was a fear of young people going slumming and getting addicted to opium in the dens of Chinatown or whatever. The risks in opium smuggling were therefore much higher. But Dunbar and Blum apparently were willing to take those risks, because obviously if you were selling a product for $50 a pound that was selling on the street for 10 times that, you could make some pretty good money. If you didn't get caught. And yes, Blum and Dunbar were definitely going to get caught, sooner or not much later. One of the more striking aspects of their story is the contrast between the size and scale of their organization's capital investments and the clumsiness of their operations. Usually smugglers this dumb don't grow this big. But of course, usually successful businessmen don't jeopardize their success by taking up high-risk criminal enterprises as a side hustle either. According to Blum's later testimony in court, because yes, it did end up in court, the criminal enterprise got started circa 1890 after one of Dunbar's friends and fellow members of the Portland business elite, James Lotan, about whom we just got done talking, was given a cushy sinecure job as chief customs collector for the Port of Portland. As we talked about last time, Lotan, the owner of the Stark Street Ferry, was also head of the Oregon Republican Party, and this was an easy federal lucrative job that was basically a political patronage plum. The chief customs collector, of course, was the top federal official in charge of making sure no one was smuggling anything into the port. As would quickly become obvious, this was like putting a fox in charge of the chicken house. Dunbar and Blum were probably already doing some low-key smuggling before this, because immediately upon receiving his new appointment, Lotan, again according to Blum, approached Blum to see about putting his newfound authority to use. This scheme that they came up with, which we went over a little bit before, it was pretty slick, though. Lotan was to generate official paperwork for each Chinese passenger. Each passenger would pay $120, that would be just south of $4,000 in modern money, to be smuggled into the country. $50 of that money went straight to Lotan for his help in the process, so he was raking off a 40% cut right off the top. The paperwork would identify the Chinese men as employees of U.S. companies, already legal residents, and who had been simply sent to Canada on business and now just needed to get back home to the U.S. The passengers would board a merchant steamship Bark in China, and after all the wheat had been offloaded, and the ship would carry them to Canada, landing in Victoria or Vancouver. There they would finalize the papers with photographs and anything else needed before boarding the Wilmington or Haitian Republic and steaming south to Portland. Upon arriving, they would be ushered in to see Lotan, who would ask them a series of questions designed to appear to confirm that the workers were entitled to, quote-unquote, return to America. These interview questions were carefully scripted, and on the way down, Chinese-speaking associates of Blum and Dunbar would instruct each worker carefully on how to answer them.
They were told the witnesses to their identity, what firm they belonged to, the amount of money they had as a share where they did business, how long they had been away from the United States, which direction the streets run, everything they would be asked upon their arrival here, Blum said.
So that was how they had it worked out. It was a slick system, and if they'd stuck to it, rather than diversifying into drug smuggling, they probably would have been able to keep it up for a good long time. But of course, they did not. It's not clear when William Dunbar and Nat Blum, the owners of the Merchant Steamship Company, started smuggling opium on their steamships, not just people. They may have been smuggling opium all along, but the astonishing rate at which opium-related disasters started piling up after mid-1892, following at least 18 months of smooth operations, suggests that before that they were only smuggling people. Smuggling opium was not only much more lucrative than smuggling people, it was also much more space-efficient. The steamers were making the trips anyway, and an extra half ton of opium wouldn't make any difference, and would add the modern equivalent of about $500,000 to the profit on the journey. To make it work, though, the opium had to not be on the ship when it tied up in port. With the help of well-placed friends at customs, a group of illegal immigrants could be passed off as legal residents returning from business trips in Canada, but illegal opium could only be disguised as legal cargo by forging tax stamps, a task the Blum-Dunbar gang didn't have the resources to attempt. Also, opium, legal or illegal, would draw a lot of attention, which obviously was never a good idea for a smuggler. So the opium, packed in watertight barrels, would be rolled off the back of the steamship in a quiet, lonely part of the Columbia River as the ship steamed past, and retrieved by gang members in rented steam launches or skiffs. This might seem like a pretty workable arrangement, but for Blum and Dunbar, the problem was that they couldn't just run down to Kelly Temporary Services and hire a couple of guys for the day to fish smuggled opium out of the river. The only people they could trust with an operation like this were actual members of Portland's criminal underworld, men like Robert Garthorne and Thomas Berg and Joseph Bunko Kelly, sailors, boarding house runners and shanghaiers and low-level drug smugglers, and they all turned out to be pretty bad at their jobs. How bad, you ask? Ah, there's where we're going to leave you on tenderhooks until tomorrow's podcast episode, but trust me, it will be worth the wait. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Offbeat Oregon, by the way, is a division of Pulplit Productions, a boutique publishing house about which more can be learned at pulp-lit.com. In addition to Offbeat Oregon books, podcasts, and audiobooks, we also publish book and audiobook versions of collections of what you might call street literature. 1920s pulp magazine writers like H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Rice Burroughs, gothic penny dreadful titles like Sweeney Todd and The Adventures of Highwayman Dick Turpin, all straight shots of bottled-in bond working man's fiction and working women's fiction from the last couple of centuries. If that sounds like your jam, I'd love to have you check them out. That is pulp-lit.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.